Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for November 23rd, 2014. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
Yes, and joining us for the hour will be one of the most knowledgeable people about politics on the internet, all the places he's been. He's also recently penned a book, and we've had him on since that came out, Dog Whistles and the political book. David Mark, welcome, David.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me back. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Well, David, I know you're on the book tour, and you've been a lot of places, both in person and on media sources. How's that book tour going?
It's going really nicely. As you alluded to, the book came out a couple months ago on September 2nd, Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes, Decoding the Jargon Slang and Bluster of American Political Speech. And I was just back in Washington, D.C. for last week for a couple of events, including one at the National Press Club Book Fair, which is always a fun kind of event, these book fairs where you get authors of all different stripes. A couple tables down from me was Congressman Jim Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina, who's in the Democratic leadership in Congress. And then the next table over was Pat Buchanan, and next to him was Ralph Nader, or I should say on the other side of me. So people are very nice. We're all there for the same purpose. So whatever differences we may have on politics, it's always interesting to meet these people. But we've been getting a lot of nice reaction to it. We spoke at a branch of the Washington, D.C. Public Library on Capitol Hill. And then I'm headed back to D.C. just after Thanksgiving for another book fair and then a talk down in Richmond, Virginia. So in addition to various radio and TV shows, including an appearance on C-SPAN, an hour-long interview, it's come out pretty nicely, and we're really pleased with the progress.
Yeah, now looking at your site, I guess you're going to be on solo on C-SPAN tonight right after our show. Finishes live, correct?
Yeah, that's right. This is a big day. It's doing this wonderful show that I'm now on, and then the C-SPAN interview, which we taped back on September 30th, but this is, to use a cliche, like we write about in the book, this is a professional dream come true to be able to be on C-SPAN and have a whole hour there to explain my ideas. This is kind of why I got into the business in the first place. So the chance to do that is just, it's an honor, and I'm really thrilled to be able to have that opportunity.
Yeah, now is that part of Book Notes, the show that's been on for, I guess, decades now?
Yeah, it's the antecedent. It's the descendant of Book Notes, which it was just about a decade ago. It was in December 2004, the show turned into Q&A because it's not always about books. It used to be a specific nonfiction book discussed each week. I think that got to be a little bit much. They also wanted to broaden it out so they could have members of Congress or other think tank folks, maybe very other important, interesting people who didn't have a book at that specific time, but had written them other times. And so it's a general question and answer show, and we get all into the book and then the contents, the concepts and ideas, and then we go discuss my career a bit. And so, again, it was just a privilege to be able to be on there for a full hour. This is why I got into the business in the first place.
Oh yeah, well, I'm planning on tuning in. I'll tell you, you were on our show last time, and just after that, we discussed the book. You were on the Political Wire podcast, you and Chuck, your other co-author, and first time I got to hear his voice, and I enjoyed listening to both of y'all on that podcast, and so probably do the same here on C-SPAN Q&A.
Well, great. It airs a couple times at in the East Coast at 8 p.m., 5 p.m. on the West Coast, And then you can, of course, find it online as well after that. I'll post it on Facebook and elsewhere. So it shouldn't be too hard to find, but it was a whole lot of fun. And, boy, you've got, when you do these interviews, you've got to be on your toes because you never know what part of the book they're going to ask or some obscure term that maybe you're not familiar with. So you just got to be ready for anything, as they say, for working as candidates know on live TV or radio.
Oh, yeah. Well, so, in addition, I have a question. Go ahead, Catherine.
I have a question. So you did the interview on September 30th, you said?
That's right, yeah. So going back.
So a lot has happened since then. It should be interesting. Did you talk at all about, like, current politics, or did you just mostly talk about the book?
It was more historical items, I think, for that very reason, because, as you know, a month, that period of time, almost 2 months now, that's an eternity in politics.
Yeah.
So, so much could change. So I think we tried to keep it pretty well focused on ideas, because I found also they rerun these interviews sometimes months later, sometimes even years later. So I think they try and keep them more evergreen so that it won't look as dated when it runs at a later time.
Yeah. Well, I guess when you're, sending it out on Facebook and tweeting it out, you can say, hey, if you want to hear my current analysis as of November 23rd, listen to the Kudzu Vine, where you can get
absolutely. That is, this color is the perfect forum for it. And that's what's fun about writing these books is these are longer form. These are ideas that you can hold for a while, that get into political history, which is wonderful. I love spending my time on that. But I also like being in the moment and discussing what's going on right now, the recent elections, being on Twitter and Facebook in that way as well. So it's fun to kind of have that longer view, but also to be in the moment and to be able to react in ways that just even 10 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, certainly most people didn't have the ability to do. But now when you're watching a political event, an interview on TV, you're getting real-time analysis. It's kind of like watching an NFL game on TV. People are commenting on it right then and there. You don't have to wait around so long.
Certainly so. Well, we know in addition to the book, you've got more upcoming projects and more freelance writing and things like that. What do you know about on the docket you can share?
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of writing for various sites, including Vice Media, V-I-C-E, which is a sort of edgy political culture site based in New York. I'm writing for Splice today, splice.com, where I've got I do a lot of freelance, do several a week there. I'm working on some longer-term projects as well, maybe working on oriented startups in Silicon Valley. So I'll have more information on that hopefully pretty soon, some new projects going on. So it's nice to be able to do a lot of different things at the same time.
Oh, certainly so. We'll keep up to date with you. And, of course, if something big may happen, we'll comment on it here. And by the end, no telling what you'll be into by the next time you come on the show. But since we got you on, it'll be your chance to tell about the current political environment. And, you know, Catherine and I came on 2 weeks ago right after the election, and all I'll say about our predictions is we were wrong. Very, very wrong.
Wrong.
I messed up with you
myself.
We're
a Democratic optimist, and so we didn't pick all Democrats, but we probably picked a few more than we should have. I guess we don't need to be doing the surf report because we didn't see quite that wave coming. But just tell us, David, kind of why you felt it happened like it did, election 2014.
Yeah, clearly we were headed for a big Republican night, and that it was clear, I'd say 2 to 3 weeks out, that Republicans were likely to take the Senate, where I think a lot of people underestimated the magnitude of the Republican win, myself included, to put all our cards on the table here. It was in governor's races, like in deep blue Democratic states like Maryland, Illinois, and Massachusetts. Those were the ones I was surprised by. I just thought the overwhelmingly Democratic electorate in those places would pull it out for the nominees of their own party, but each has specific cases. Part of this has to do, of course, with the much-discussed idea of a different electorate in the midterms, where it's older, whiter, and just frankly smaller. It's a lot fewer people vote in midterm elections than do in presidential years, and that favors Republicans to the extreme. You combine that with this being the sixth year of a presidency, and usually that favors the opposition party from the president. I think there's just this general feeling of anxiety, economic anxiety out there, not to mention trouble in the world with ISIL, with Ebola, and other places, and just kind of a perfect storm. Now, American politics, it swings on a pendulum. It's cyclical, so this is not a death knell for Democrats by any chance, any measure. But I think where it really hurts Democrats is it, a couple of states that they thought they had really nailed down for presidential races are now in play again, like Colorado and Virginia. In Colorado, Republicans won a Senate seat. They actually, the Cory Gardner knocked off, defeated Mark Udall, the sitting Democratic senator. In Virginia, Democratic Senator Mark Warner nearly lost in a race that almost nobody thought was going to be competitive. So that forces Democrats to put time and resources back into those states. And also up in New England, Republicans picked off a couple of House seats in New Hampshire and Maine. So it means that that region is not completely locked down either. So I think that's the real bad news for the Democrats. If there's any good news, it's that it's kind of the inverse of what I just said, that in presidential years, you look at the states that Democrats have won all six elections from 1992 on, like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and they did pretty well there. So they won an open seat Senate race in Michigan. They defeated a sitting Republican governor in Pennsylvania, and some other states had similar results. So it means that even though Colorado and Virginia are now in play, these other states, the map still looks relatively decent for the Democrats. So it was a bad night for them, but I don't think it was a total washout.
Yeah, and there's so many factors underneath it. And I think obviously the Democratic Party said, we're going to do, you know, intensive turnout efforts. And I think it actually worked in some places where they were able to get to the vote. It's just, you know, you pick a large city or two in a state and you do these great turnout efforts, but there's just so many places across whatever state you talk about to turn all these voters that are hard to turn in out. And then if you don't do better with just the voters that are going to show up without much effort, it's tough. Is this a problem where the Democratic Party needs to look at, you know, just maybe spending five times as much on turnout efforts to then turn out the maybe smaller cities that have some Democratic base vote, or do they need to work on harder to reach, maybe older, whiter, married, whatever voters that we're not doing as well with?
That's a great question. That's the real conundrum Democrats are facing. And I think when you look like a state like Georgia, which you know real well, Democrats had high hopes for getting that electorate turnout with the growing Hispanic voters, even Asian Americans, and others. And looking at the after the exit polls and the after action reports, it does seem like there was some more voter motivation. But to make up for the white Republican vote, you've got to get out in a magnitude of 2 to 3 times as the opposition. And so I think it's a little bit of each. I think definitely Democrats have to find a way to make sure that those votes come out from minority groups, particularly in the face of voter ID laws and some of these other problems, which are really bad and they shouldn't happen, but they're on the books at this point. So I think Democrats should spend more time working around those. And that actually worked in the 2012 presidential race in Pennsylvania, where they were able to get around some restrictive voter ID measures because they just mobilized better. They got part of it stopped in court, but they still just turned people out. But I also think you hit on a really important point. Democrats still have this ongoing problem with white working class voters. This goes back to the losing presidential elections of the 1980s, and that's a really tough needle to thread. But I think Democrats would be really foolish to just forget those voters. So I think they've got to do both.
Yeah, I mean, I just think any vote, you know, counts. And then if you can get a vote out of one column and put it in another column, that helps. You talked about the voter ID laws. And I was driving through Gadsden, Alabama this weekend. My daughter had a basketball tournament. And I'm coaching another team over there, not to give sell them short too, but Gadsden, Alabama. Alabama, I think at this point maybe the worst state for Democrats in the union. I saw two different billboards that were aimed at African-American voters, looking at the actual set, said, don't forget to bring your ID, had a young African-American lady, had her holding her driver's license up, you know, kind of saying, like, you know, you need your ID out. So there, the Democratic Party or Democratic efforts more so were, you know, trying to fight those voter ID laws. So I think in every corner, you know, Democrats are doing what they can. It's just a tough haul. And as we can see, in Alabama, you know, those races weren't even close. It was so bad there. You talked about exit polls, which we talked extensively about. NBC, that was the source I looked at, didn't even do exit polls in the state of Alabama.
Yeah.
I guess they didn't think there would be much to find there, even though they had a governor and a Senate race. So I was kind of surprised by that. Catherine, any questions for Mark? I mean, David Mark on election 2014.
No, I think I agree with him in all regard. I think that just my the work that I did with the state table here in Georgia, we've done some, you know, we have some data back, not all of it, because it takes a while for all the Secretary of State data to come in, but just the sort of top line, the places where we worked, the turnout was better for progressive candidates.
Mm-hmm.
The turnout was better, and because of, you know, how we targeted, the turnout was better for progressive candidates. So I think, I guess my sort of lesson and takeaway is that we've just got to start earlier, and we've got to talk to voters, and it's the hardest work in electoral politics. It's absolutely torture. To walk the neighborhoods and talk to people and find the people. And it's really hard because what you're doing is targeting. So you're not going to every door. You're going to every sixth or eighth door. So it's that much more difficult for, you know, the actual canvassers. But it works. And I hope that some of our political operatives will see this data and recognize that we can't spend all our money on media anymore. We just can't. It doesn't work. And, you know, just buying more television commercials is not the solution. It doesn't work. And we saw that in Georgia. I mean, I think that if, you know, some of the money that was spent on commercials for our top two candidates had been spent on ground efforts, I think we would have seen some, I don't know that we would have won, but we would have seen different results.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear, and I think an important point that there's a whole political consulting class that says you have to run television commercials. And, of course, it's not just because they get fees from it. They do, many do have a direct financial interest in that, but the thinking is that then that generates media coverage, which begets campaign contributions. But the elections these days, as you suggest, are all about turnout, and there's not a whole lot of undecided voters left anymore. So it's about getting your folks out on election day, and it's doubly tough in a state like Georgia, where you've got a pretty entrenched white Republican establishment there. But the numbers suggest that there's still hundreds of thousands of potential voters there, African-American citizens, Hispanics, et cetera, who are ripe for registering and just kind of getting into the habit of voting in the midterms. That's really hard, and it's not sexy. You don't get the same flash as you do from a TV commercial, but that's what wins elections. And it probably takes years of advanced planning to pull that off.
Right. And I think that as we sit around our state table, we talk about starting, you know, in April 2015, talking to people, because it really is about talking directly to people. I mean, we know, everybody knows this, but nobody wants to admit it. Nobody wants to do the work, because it's hard work. I mean, it is.
Right.
Yeah,
it's
I remember.
Laborious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go ahead, David. I remember, David, a seminar you helped coordinate for campaign elections back in 2002. I heard Doc Schweitzer say at one of the seminars, you know, that bat box is magic, talking about TV. And I think he was right when he said it. You know, those commercials, if you can get people to watch them and they're good enough and they're interesting enough and the voter is open to listen to it, if you put a really good commercial together, it can change your mind. The only trick is since that time in the last 12 years, everybody's gone from VCRs to DVRs, where you can just skip commercials. And some shows, like on Dish, it'll just skip the commercial for you. And so many poor people like the news. Everybody loves to advertise on the news. Some people now don't watch the local newscast. They still are informed, but just click on the internet and see the stories they want to see. And then you can get into web ads and still do the same kind of concept. You just put it in a different format. But I think that's what's changed, and it's hard for, you know, whatever time you came up in, you're used to that, and it's hard to change, whereas the next round of consultants will be more of the internet generation fully, as opposed to probably ones that are a little older than you and me and even Catherine that were, you know, came up in the
even
TV
Catherine. But, you know, I have to tell you, all the evidence, all the research, everybody knows that the single most effective thing to persuade a voter is to talk to them face to face. It is the single most successful thing, and it is the most expensive and the most difficult, but it works.
Yeah, and so it's just things are changing to where it's different, and obviously I think you're right about getting voters to come out, and I think the concept of nesting has to be, you know, more emphasized, and I'm going to use Georgia. I wish I had a house district in another state, and I know there's plenty. I'm sure there was some in Florida, in which it might have been easier to find voters in, say, DeKalb County and Hank Johnson's district that really wasn't a targeted district that was in play, as opposed to going out to, say, Augusta, Georgia and Savannah, Georgia, and maybe trying to change those voters. And at the same time, you put voters into all the up-ballot races, but then you help the congressional candidate. And so I think a lot of times, even in the presidential in 2016, they're going to have to look at states in which you have a competitive Senate district. The states, you know, in play for the presidential race, and then maybe nested underneath with some congressional races. And states like that, I think, are going to be real key because, you know, whomever the Democratic nominee is, obviously the Republican nominee will have to try to protect their majorities. But if the Democratic nominee comes in, I'm supposing to Hillary Clinton, she comes in and wins the presidency but doesn't really take back the Senate or the House, her possible power to get things done is going to be greatly restricted. So you really, if you want to make big changes in the country, you're going to have the legislative branch and the executive branch. David, do you see that as a challenge? David? Let me look at my switchboard. Catherine, you there with me?
I'm here.
Okay. David must have dropped off, and I'm putting him right back on. David, I hope you could hear me but just couldn't speak to me when you dropped off. I pulled back up the switchboard. Do you see that as a challenge for, let's say, the next Democratic president if they don't control the Senate and the House?
It's a huge challenge, and this has the potential to make their life miserable, be it Hillary Clinton or somebody else. We'll see what happens there. I think Democrats are probably going to want to put in a lot of attention and resources into taking back the Senate in 2016. Of course, they'll be down, it looks like, assuming Mary Landrieu loses in Louisiana, 54-46. It's a tough road to climb out of. But I think there are some reasons for optimism for Democrats, even if you look across just the state line.
Yeah, I'm going to check the board again. According to this, David's in good shape with us. Oh, he dropped off again. I'm going to try to pick him back up. But, you know, David was mentioning Mary Landrieu's race, and that was one of our other topics. So while we're getting him back, we can talk about that. There was a poll taken both on Mary Landrieu's race, showed her, I believe, down by 15 points, 55 40. I guess that would leave 5% undecided. Even if she took it all, it would still have her losing by 10 points. Also showed Edwin Edwards down as well, and I think he actually had further to go. Obviously, he's kind of a politician from the past in many ways instead of the current Louisiana. But, I mean, that's such a tough race. Catherine, what do you think our chances are on holding Louisiana in the Senate race, much less the House seat?
I think it's going to be really tough to hold that Senate seat. It's going to require a lot of ground, a really good ground game to get people out to vote. That's always our problem.
David, you're talking about it as a segue. Yeah, you're back, and we put you back in and all, and we used your Mary Landrieu comment as a segue into that. you were saying you feel she's going to lose, and, you know, she's one of the most amazing politicians in recent Louisiana history, and in the South would win tough races like in 2002, but this looks like it may be the end of the line for her.
Yeah, I think this one is pretty tough at this point. Part of it is just Louisiana is such a red Republican state at this point. It's amazing how much it's really turned. Also, I think what they're facing in the Republican nominee, Congressman Bill Cassidy, is a problem that Democrats really had throughout this past election cycle. I think Democrats were really hoping and really depending on self-inflicted wounds by Republican nominees like they had in 2010 and 2012, like Richard Murdoch, Sharon Angle, Christine O'Donnell, Ken Buck, some others. And that's a hope, but it's not a strategy. And Bill Cassidy, the Republican nominee, has run a boring campaign. He's not really an electric speaker, but he hasn't really made any big mistakes. And I just think there's enough working against Senator Landrieu. Also, the fact her big calling card has been that she would be chairwoman of the Energy Committee in the Senate, having to do with Keystone Pipeline, et cetera. And that's not going to be true anymore. Even if she was still going to chair it, I still don't think voters would care very much. But so, I think her time is up, and this is going to be a tough loss for her.
Yeah, and really the whole Landrieu family, because you've got brother Mitch, who was had been lieutenant governor, now the mayor of New Orleans. You had her father Moon, who was longtime New Orleans mayor. So that's a family that used to winning. You mentioned the Keystone Pipeline. That's kind of a two-sided. That brings up kind of two things for me on Mary Landrieu's race. One, you know, Catherine, you mentioned all the ground game. You know, you're going to have to go out there and really do a massive voter turnout. They did this in 2002, but it just seems like because we have the White House instead of not having the White House, that's going to play against us. And so you have to wonder, does the Democratic Party want to expend outside resources on this seat? And then also the Keystone Pipeline, you know, is something that most Democrats are against. And so if you said, hey, we could do this and maybe be against our principles, but it would save this seat, it'd be one thing. And I'm not saying it's even the right thing to do. I'm just saying it'd be one thing. But I get the feeling that Mary Landrieu, President Obama, they could work together and pass the Keystone Pipeline tomorrow, and she'd still lose. So then you really have to, in my mind, question, is this worth it? David, what do you think the Democrats thinking at this point?
I think the Democrats' view on this is pretty clear from where they put their money, or more specifically, not put their resources. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has apparently pulled out of Louisiana or taken its ads off the air. And if you just look at the polling, it's consistently now 56-41 for Cassidy or somewhere in that range, maybe somewhat tighter, but it's still at least a 10-point margin. So I think Democrats have to be real concerned because, as you say, this is the Keystone Pipeline is an issue that splits the party. Mary Landrieu is in the minority there. There's just no doubt about it. She's going against her own party. Maybe it's good policy. Maybe it's not. I'll leave it to, up to other energy experts to decide on that. But she's going against her own party, so I think she's not really getting a whole lot of help. They're trying in the Senate, Harry Reid, the majority leader, is trying to clear the way for her to at least get a vote on it. But it's a strange sensation to allow the vote, but then have a majority of members vote against it. In some ways, it kind of plays up why she's just not in the party that's likely to be with people in Louisiana. So I think this is just a really tough issue for her right now.
Yeah, Catherine, I mean, you see the dynamic here. Is this something that is even we'll take it utilitarian, not looking at the how one feels about the issue, but is it even worth it to expend, you know, vote against your own belief, if you will?
Well, I think, you know, I think these are really tough questions, because I think if it was if Mary Landrieu were the deciding senator, you know, if it was going to be up to her who carried the Senate, then I think we would probably think it was worth it.
Mm-hmm.
But since we already don't have the Senate, I think it becomes less of a it becomes less valuable. And because of the Keystone Pipeline and the, you know, but, you know, I got to say, we say that Democrats are against it, but it was something that Michelle Nunn tried to run on in being in favor of it. I think Southern Democrats, for some reason, are in favor of Keystone. I don't get it because, well, that's a whole other discussion. But so I think that right now it's probably not worth the effort.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say that because, you know, I hate to lose a Senate seat, but you know, how I mean, if there was a path that we could say, oh yeah, if we spend this much money and we do X, Y, and Z, we can be pretty confident that we'll win. I don't think there's a. I mean, I'm not an expert, but I don't see the path.
Right.
Yeah,
I don't think that's pretty accurate. I agree with that.
Yeah, I think David, you're right. I saw a poll that was a 15-point poll. I believe it was 55-40, so the same divide. I mean, and you know, she gets every undecided voter from that poll. You still have to, that's 10 points. You have to assume that then the methodology of the poll is really flawed, and not flawed like a lot of the other polls were, where they might have been a little too Democratic. This one would have to be wildly too Republican, and that's the real problem. One thing I do find a little bit ironic about Louisiana voters, the Keystone Pipeline, I mean, the things I've seen about it is the real criticism of it, obviously, is, you know, when they were doing this in some of the, you know, limited stuff in Pennsylvania, some people's water would be flammable. You could take a lighter and natural gas would come through the pipes and contaminate the water, mess up some land. If you would think there was any state that was a little bit sensitive to environmental issues, one would think it would be Louisiana after the BP spill. But I guess there's just more people that have jobs out of oil refining and what have you off the coast than are hurt directly by, you know, the environmental damage. But I just thought that was such a strange thing. You think the BP spill would have made Louisianans more pro-environment, but it either's made no difference or maybe made them more anti-environment.
No, I think that they've been sold. I mean, we could talk for an hour about the problems with Keystone Pipeline, and you know that's just one of them. But
mm-hmm.
I think we've
I think
people have been sold a bill of goods about Keystone Pipeline, that there's jobs, there aren't really that many jobs, that it's going to be good for energy prices. It's not going to make any. It's probably not going to help any of that because we're not going to get any of that oil. But you know that's not the way it's being sold, and the people who are selling it have more influence than the people who have the more realistic information, I think.
I think both of you make
excellent points that I think when you talk about economic concerns, people care about jobs, and conservatives are likely to be more in favor of oil drilling or transportation, whatever you want to call it. And whatever the merits of it, which you're describing, Catherine, or lack of merits, it doesn't matter. I think it's just not a winning issue for Mary Landrieu. Sometimes you just get in these situations where it's just you're dealing a bad hand. It's like you're playing poker and you just don't get the cards, or Scrabble,
right, exactly.
You don't get the letters. And I just think that's what she's facing right now.
Yeah, and it just seems kind of funny. And also, you look at the national gas prices, in which, I'll be honest, I think a lot of times the president, be the Democratic or Republican, doesn't have a lot of direct impact over OPEC and the oil prices.
Has none.
Which you think even Republicans would not be could not really use the current gas prices against the current administration. I mean, they're like $2.75. Now, that's in my state. I'm sure out when David's pumping in California, it's over $3, but it's still probably like 60 cents cheaper than most of the, you know, Bush administration. So you'd think that they're probably like, well, cheap gas, it's a good bit cheaper than it was. This isn't probably the number one pressing need. David, we saw those charts that showed where the gas price would go up. President Bush's approval rating would fall. The gas price would go down a little bit. It would raise a little bit. It was almost completely tied. How come President Obama sees no, seemingly no positive impact based on gas prices?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is something that really perplexed me during the campaign, the run up to Election Day on November 4th, that gas prices have been declining for, let's say, a couple months now, and this is almost like a tax rebate for those of us, most of us who have to drive someplace to get to work, to do our daily business, et cetera. And you would think it would be more helpful. For whatever reason, President Obama, the administration, they're not good at touting these economic numbers. Even unemployment is at 5.8%, which is actually historically decent. It's a heck of a lot better than where it was when he took office. But for whatever reason, they don't play these up. They kind of let Republicans go on the offense about it. And I think a lot of Democrats are rather ticked off about this.
Yeah, I do see that narrative, and that kind of came up in the first debate in 2012. Sometimes he's just not that willing to fight back for whatever reason. Maybe he sees it beneath him. Maybe he's just not naturally a, you know, combative fighter. I don't know, but I do hear that criticism a lot. Well, let's stay on the president and talk about a national issue. This big issue of the past week actually led off Saturday Night Live with it, and that's, you know, lets you know that it's in the national consciousness, and that's the executive order granting citizenship to a good number. I'm not sure the exact, you know, million
not citizenship.
Number of, or not citizenship, I'm sorry, amnesty. Right. Right word? Okay. To undocumented workers. And discuss.
Let's
yeah,
not get the right wing all fired up.
5 years. Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sure. Hey, somebody else has probably claimed that the other way. It was for me. It was just verbal faux pas. But for somebody else, they probably are trying to say that's really happening. But anyway, it's this, you know, major issue with being an executive order, and I don't know that anyone's like totally comfortable with the way it happened, because I see that it's kind of, even if people kind of agree with the actual policy, but the Republicans are kind of wanting to go so far the other way, the president felt pushed into a corner. David, how do you think this is going to, what kind of implications do you think this will have for the first few months of the new Congress, and then politics moving forward?
Yeah, this is something that Democrats, President Obama, are probably on the short end of in the immediate near term, but they may actually come out ahead a few years down the line, which is small comfort. We just had an election wall being like Democrats just had this last time around. A majority of people in the polls, maybe a fairly narrow majority, like 56%, somewhere around there, are against this type of action. But I think down the road, it has the potential to register more voters. I think Democrats can also spin this forward by saying, you know what, this is a family values measure. Mm-hmm. This is something that's trying to reunite families, not tear them apart. Immigration is always a tough issue. I actually don't have a real problem with what President Obama has done here. The Senate passed an immigration overhaul bill a year and a half ago. It's been sent over to the House. Maybe if House Republicans don't like everything that's in it, they could counteroffer, they could come up with their own plan. But I don't have a problem with presidents taking executive action as long as it's in their ability to do so. And this is rather limited what the president did. I guess just during the Bush years,
President Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, played up the notion of executive action to such a great degree, the unitary executive, it's kind of hard for me to take seriously a lot of Republican criticisms just a few years later.
Yes. Catherine, now, Saturday Night Live, you know, they had President Obama pushing the bill, the metaphorical bill from Schoolhouse Rock down the stairs, you know, like he was just totally ignoring the Constitution. You know, Saturday Night Live usually thought to be more of a liberal satire bunch. What kind of blowback do you think this may have?
Well, you know, the thing that I think the blowback's going to be minimal, because I think that, you know, as soon as the Republicans start shouting about it, everybody's going to remind them that Reagan and the first Bush and the second Bush all did a large number of executive orders, and some of them were much more dramatic than this. So, and some of them were about immigration as well. But the thing that bothers me about it is, why didn't he do it 6 weeks ago? That's the only thing that, you know. But I think that,
well,
I think David makes a really good point that this is absolutely a family values issue. I mean, I heard a number of stories on NPR over the past week interviewing families who, you know, were going to be split apart, were at the, you know, at the very precipice of losing their homes and losing and being separated from their children who had been born here. And were, you know, 10, 11 years old or whatever. So, yeah, I think this is a family values. In addition to other, I have other things, it's a very important family, keeping families together. And keeping, you know, hardworking, tax-paying Americans in the country. I mean, you know, it's...
Mm-hmm. Well, Catherine, you say why didn't do it 6 weeks ago. One of the best political quotes that was not a political quote, Chris Christopherson, freedom's another word for nothing left to lose. I mean, you know, he might have thought, oh, this may cost me a Senate seat, and, you know, Colorado may have blowback, blah, 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 you know. But now it's like, well, can't get no worse. This is probably going to be a major issue in the Louisiana Senate race. Maybe gone anyway. I'll do what I want to do. So it may be that he's more has more freedom just to serve and say what he wants to more for the last, you know, the last 2 years of his term. Now let's move into 2016, since we got David on with us, and let's just kind of, you know, have this hypothetical scenario. And Harold Ickes actually, you know, came up with this scenario. If you had Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee, Jeb Bush is the Republican nominee. Let's just say for whatever reason, Hillary Clinton says, you know, comes out, they ask her about it, and she says, I don't think I would have used the executive action or the executive order to do this. But then Jeb Bush, you know, trying to be very pro-Hispanic, maybe one of the most pro-Hispanic politicians in the Republican Party, says, I have no problem with what President Obama did. What do you think it would do to the Republican-Democratic dynamic for a lot of those hardcore Tea Party folks that this is like the number one or two issue for them is immigration? Because we know that there's a it's not a majority, but it's a plurality, certainly the Tea Party folks, that care so passionately about this. And if the parties, you know, switched in some really – minor way, because here I'm saying that she would said that she wouldn't do the executive order. It wasn't that she really changed opinions, if you will. David, if that were to happen, what would these Tea Party folks do? Catherine, won't you hop in and I'll
okay.
look at the
board.
Well,
first
the
of all,
board.
I don't think that. I mean, I think that it would be a really surprising move for Jeb Bush to do something like that before he got the nomination.
Yeah.
And so
yeah, he's
once
gotta
he
got to go hard to the right. Yeah.
Right. So if he said it after he got the nomination, it wouldn't matter because the, you know, they're not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. maybe they stay home, but I don't think they stay home if it's Hillary Clinton on the, you know, if they have to pick between pro-immigration Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, they're going to pick pro-immigration Jeb Bush. So I don't,
or
I think
a third-party
that,
candidate.
Or a third-party candidate, but.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's hard to see Jeb Bush coming out for something like this while he's running for president, if indeed he does run. But it just shows you this is a case of situational outrage, where you, David, alluded to the fact that Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush made similar, like, type executive orders, and in some cases they were blatantly political. In one case for Reagan, he was to let Nicaraguans in the country during the height of Iran-Contra against the alleged communist regime down there. So there's been politics involved in this for years, for decades, and that's why I don't really have a problem with what President Obama did. Maybe it'll hurt them politically, but I think people will get past it.
Yeah, and I think Catherine's the one that actually alluded to it, so I'll give her the credit on that. But whatever it is, it's really politically, it's not, you know, President Obama that's going to have the will get the gain or the fallout because he's not on the ballot anymore. But now, keeping with the Hillary Clinton / Jeb Bush, Rob Portman our scenario, one of Hillary Clinton advisor, Heldicke, said, you know, if Jeb Bush was the nominee for president, he put Rob Portman from Ohio as his vice presidential candidate, that could be very hard to overcome. I do think that the supposition is that Jeb Bush wins Florida and Rob Portman wins Ohio. I don't know that you lock down your home state anymore just from being there. David, do you feel this is some just killer recipe, or do you think that Jeb Bush would have to fight for his home state just as hard as his brother did, President Obama and John McCain did, President Clinton in 96 did, or does he just win it because he's the home state hero?
No, I don't think he wins it automatically at all, nor would Ohio necessarily go for Rob Portman as the running mate. First off, there's a lot of ifs in that scenario with Hillary Clinton being the nominee, Jeb Bush winning the Republican nod, and Rob Portman being the vice presidential pick. So a lot of hypotheticals there. But let's just say we did get that far. Jeb Bush, to a lot of Democrats in Florida, is a very divisive figure. He doesn't look as crazy to them maybe now as some of the Tea Party folks, but they remember the governorship years. They are not happy about a lot of policies he put in place. So I think there would be a big turnout against him. And even in Ohio, the Democrats have won that twice now, in 2008 and 2012 in the presidential races. They're going to be eager to try and do that again. So I don't think there's anything that's automatic about those states.
Yeah. Catherine, in that article that we kind of based this off of from the Daily Beast, it said, you know, Jeb Bush favors Common Core. He favors liberalized immigration policy. Bob Portman's son is a homosexual, and he favors gay marriage. And so do you think those two gentlemen could really be a Republican ticket and keep the Republican ticket intact, or the Republican Party intact, with, you know, stances that are against maybe a lot of the hardcores in their party?
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see if these, you know, some of these social issues come up in 2016, because I think that all these Republicans who are on the wrong side of marriage equality are going to find themselves in tough trouble if they start talking about it. Because I think, you know, what is it, 36 states now? I mean, come on. That story's over, and they need to shut up about it. And the other thing is, how long are we going to have to listen to Harold Ickes?
I don't know. Now,
you know what
now,
I mean?
Catherine,
like,
I think you're... here's the thing. If Hillary Clinton wants to listen to him, then he does matter in, you know, in the political world, if you will. Now, Catherine, you make a great point that as far as voters, particularly younger voters, voters that are probably going to be the future of America and future thinking, not just an age. You know, marriage equality, that ship did sail. 2002 was the last time I think that, you know, dog really hunted in campaigns as far as a general election issue. But the problem is a lot of times the Republican primary, you know, it's like a, you know, a meeting at a Piccadilly cafeteria. I mean, it's skewed
right.
a little
oh,
different
right.
than everywhere else. And so it may just be that you could still win an Iowa caucus, you know, campaigning against Jeb Bush or Rob Portman. I go, it's hard to campaign against the vice presidential nominee in the caucus, but still, I mean, they're going to have some sway and influence in who he picks and does he lose the party. And it also looks at, you have to look at where the third party movement is, because it always creeps up. In some years, it has a little more gas and legs than others. And you can't really
tell
until it's close to election time.
I don't know. I just think that if that's going to be an important issue in the primary for the Republicans, then they're going to lose more badly than I expect them to.
Right.
I mean, if they're talking about marriage equality in the primary and not talking about jobs and the environment, or if they're going to still do this, you know, anti-environment stuff, I think they're just, I mean, they have to get with the program. It's going to be 2016. These issues are done and decided, and they need to come up with other things to enliven their base.
Yeah, but
yeah,
if you look at
the last time,
because I don't think
election,
the base is going to get fired up about marriage equality as much as they did before.
The same
because
base.
Everybody's got a gay person in their family or in their workplace or in their, and the more that we see them, the more that people are like, yeah, you know, this isn't fair. You know, why can't this person? I mean, it's becoming more and more part of the mainstream and main fabric of America. And in 2 years, I don't think, I mean, I could be way off base, but I think it's going to be a troublesome topic for them if they keep talking about it negatively.
But Catherine, this is the same base that, you know, the last time they had a presidential election, Michelle Bachmann won the Iowa Ames straw poll. Rick Santorum, he won the actual Iowa caucus. Won some other states down the line. I mean, Rick Santorum kept running as the conservative alternative, you know, to Mitt Romney.
Yeah, and where is Rick Santorum today?
You know, the Duck Dynasty controversy came out. You know, you would think that Phil guy would be, you know, if I could touch him. A&E, Arts and Entertainment Television, was forced to put him back on, essentially, because he had so much support. You know, after Dan Cathy made the comments, that gave money, it was milder than what that Phil character said. They had eat a chicken biscuit day, and they had, like, record company sales. I mean, there is a hardcore portion of the American public, and once again, it's portion nowhere near majority, but this portion that feels that they're just losing everything about the culture and this, that, the other. I'm not saying they're right. I'm just saying they're there in a democracy. They get to vote. And they get to vote in big numbers in the Republican primary, and that's where.
But I think those numbers are diminishing. That's what
candidates.
I'm saying. I think those numbers are diminishing.
Yeah,
oh,
but
they were in a roller coaster free fall, but then they've hit that spot where they've gone down to, and I'd have to see a poll, but, you know, 30% of the electorate, which if it's 70-30, that's really nothing, but that 30% electorate, but it's just not moving down much more. It's hit that little spot where it's going to take a few more years, you know, honestly, some more generational change to bring it down further. And that 30% inside the Republican Party might become 60% of their party. And that gets a little trickier. David, anything you think here?
No, David, I agree with you. You look at like somebody like Senator Ted Cruz, who is a probable presidential candidate on the Republican side in 2016, he's going to push this issue as far as he can. And I think if anything, Republicans have learned from this last election is even if you have a smaller base, if they're potent and they vote consistently, that's probably who they're going to turn to. So that's why I'm skeptical of somebody like Rob Portman, who does favor marriage equality,
is going to get very far.
Yeah, and Catherine, once again, I think you're right about the majority of folks, and I think as far as even the folks that may not be totally in agreement, it's not some big issue with them, but here's the sad thing. NBC did a poll with the Wall Street Journal, and they said, you know, what do you want Congress to focus on? And they took this, you know, the 14th through 17th, after the election, you know, number one, lower-cost student loans. They want, you know, more help paying for college. Increased spending on infrastructure, raising the minimum wage, funding to fight Ebola in Africa. So, you know, not just quarantine folks, but actually fight it overseas. Addressing climate change and reducing carbon emissions. That was the top five. Number six was, be fair to conservatives and Republicans, building the Keystone Pipeline. Five out of six issues are Democratic issues, yet the voters, you wouldn't know it from the actual people they voted for, I mean. Catherine, why is the disconnect here between people's priorities and how they vote?
It's a branding problem for the Democrats, I think. I hate to
say it. I think you're right. And that's why I'm never willing to give up on, you know, fighting for voters, irregardless of their age, their race. I think the issues are with us. The brand's bad, and we need to, you know, not change our opinions on anything, but try to sell these top five issues and say, this is what we're for. We're Democrats. Maybe give us a second look. David, what do you think the problem here is?
Yeah, I think the Democrats have the issues on their side in many ways when it comes to marriage equality and these other issues that you're describing, but there is that hardcore base of Republicans who get passionate about that, and that's the problem Democrats really have, is getting their own voters to be as passionate on these issues as Republicans are on theirs, on the inverse, and that works a whole lot better during presidential years, but they've got to find a way to do it during these off-year midterm elections, as we've been discussing.
Yeah. David, we're about to run out of time, and I want to give you a chance to plug your book possibly with a question. We talked about a lot of these candidates like Allison London Grimes, Natalie Tennant, Michelle Nunn, Jason Carter, but the last two actually said in the Atlanta Constitution they may put their name on the ballot again. Is there a word, and if there's not a word, in dog whistles, walkbacks, and Washington handshakes that refers to the comeback candidate or a second-time candidate, that's fine. You can just give us your analysis on if candidates can run again. But I don't know if there's some special jargon for, you know, candidates other than maybe calling them retreads, because all four of these folks are young and vibrant. So that didn't quite fit. He is calling them something, you know, with negative connotations like that.
That's a great question. I don't think we do have a term for that specifically. I can call them comeback bids, or it depends who they are. Sometimes that applies. Sometimes if they lost narrowly and ran a closer than expected race, there's one term. If they were expected to do better and then lost badly, that doesn't reflect as well on them. But of all those candidates you mentioned, I think Michelle Nunn maybe has the best chance. She didn't do, frankly, that well in the Senate Georgia Senate race. They missed the runoff, so you can't say she really succeeded. But it seems like she acquitted herself pretty well on the campaign trail. Maybe Jason Carter, Allison Lundgren Grimes. She already is Secretary of State in Kentucky, so that's something. It was Natalie Tennant in West Virginia, but when you lose that badly, it's tough to see running statewide in those places again, maybe for a congressional seat or something like that.
Yeah, and West Virginia has really, you know, turned in a hard way. Catherine, what do you think on those four candidates? Can certain ones of all four have shots to run again? I mean, it's statewide, not, you know, a state house seat or something.
I think, you know, I'm most familiar with Jason Carter and Michelle Nunn, and I actually think Jason Carter, of the ones that I'm most familiar with, has the best shot at running again for governor in 2018 or whatever. I think Michelle Nunn could pull it off. I would probably, if she asked me, I'd probably recommend that she try to run for Congress or for, you know, county commission or something first, but, you know. Alison Lundgren Grimes, you know, I just think she, I just don't think she did a very good job of that campaign. I think we had high hopes for her, and she did have some high points and some moments, but I think her, some of the things she did, it's going to be pretty hard to come back off of not being able to say whether you voted for the president, when we all know she voted for the president. She was a delegate to the convention. So,
right.
You know, I mean, I think that kind of thing, it was kind of a boneheaded move, and I think it's hard to come back after something like that.
Well, she was a Hillary Clinton delegate, and maybe the fact if Hillary Clinton become, you know, the nominee, maybe she can somehow sell it. Now, that could be her ticket to come back, and I think after Jason Carter, she might be the second most one, because no matter how many times she stick her foot in her mouth about that, a lot of the people in Kentucky seem to still like her. I think the wave got her more so than even those misstatements got her, and so maybe she says, you know, I'm more understanding that I will stand with the party, two folks in the party, and then if he's like, hey, I'm really a Hillary Clinton Democrat, and she's the head of the party in 2 years through 10 years from now, let's say, that's going to give her some, you know, more cover, if you will. So those are the two
I
see going to come back. Yeah. Well, David, before we close out, I'm probably DVRing you right now, but tell
okay.
people once again where they can read you, hear you, anything else.
Yeah, just go to dogwhistlebook.com, and there's all information about the book, upcoming appearances, et cetera.
Yeah, all right. Well, if you're listening live, turn us off. Turn on C-SPAN. If you're listening as a podcast, look up C-SPAN, Q&A, David Mark, hear his interview. And, David, thanks again for coming on the Kudzu Vine.
Thanks
okay,
so much, David. It was great having you.
Talk to you next time.
Good night, everybody.
Good evening, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
With a strong and united...